That's what up. Hello again. This is Race Talk with Brian Redman today. Did you know all our shows are recorded and you can listen to them forever on Racing History Project website? Also on the Internet Archive, archive.org, and a number of podcast platforms. If you've missed any of our previous shows, they're all on our website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and on podcasts from iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, and Spotify, now reaching millions of fans. Download the apps and listen on your phone, car radio, or computer. Today is a very special event. I'm excited and honored to speak one-on-one with Brian Redman, whose racing background spans decades on all the storied and challenging tracks in the world, driving everything from Can-Am, Formula One, Camel GT, Formula 5000, to wins at Spa, Daytona, Sebring, and amassing four world championships, world manufacturers championships, and five individual titles, including three consecutive Formula 5000 champs and an IMSA Camel GT championship, just to name a few. So audiences, please mute your phones. If you have a question, just send it via chat and our producer will pass it along. Good afternoon, Mr. Redman. We are delighted to have you with us today. Thank you for joining us. You must be the one contemporary driver with the widest variety of interviews, podcasts, magazine articles, and books devoted to you in the history of racing history. You've answered the same questions over and over for years, so I won't presume to top those. But instead, I would like to focus on your racing years in North America. If you would allow me to pose a group of questions to comprise the chapters of this talk. If you would like to start with some background of your career, please do. Okay? Take it away.
Okay. Well, I started racing in 1959 in a Morris 1000 Woody, a traveler's car, that I used for delivering mop heads, those woolly things that you clean the floors with, all over the north of England. I put a supercharger on it, and it was as fast as an MGA. Big deal. The following year, I went to a Mini, 848cc Mini. The following year, to an XK120 Jaguar. Following year, to a Morgan Plus 4. And so the years went by until 1967. A friend of mine said that I want to turn professional, and when I asked what that meant, he said it means I'll pay you 30 quid a week, £30 a week, about $50 at that time, guaranteed for a year with a car and a mechanic. And I started doing Formula 2, open wheel, single seaters, and in fact, I never drove a single seater of any kind until I was 30 years of age. I've been driving lightweight Jaguar E-types, Lola T70 Can-Am cars. And so the first race in America was Daytona in 1968, driving with the Belgian wonderboy, Jackie X, although he was known in the team as the younger Brussels Sprout. Unfortunately, the gearbox broke at an early stage. Second gear went in the horseshoe, particularly in the evening, and we were out. And so it was my first time in America, and the second time was only a few weeks later when we went to Sebring, and I made a really rookie mistake. I tried to outbrake Joe Siffert in the factory Porsche 907 at the end of the back straight, and because there was lots of room, I thought, if I make a mistake and spin, it won't matter too much. But what I did, whilst I was still going backwards, I got it into first gear, and I gave it a quick rev, and thinking I'd be spinning the wheels and flying away, instead the clutch exploded. And John Wire, the team owner, said to me, Redman, I'd like you to write out 100 times, I must not release the clutch when I'm going backwards.
That brings me to a question. I've heard you say that the Porsche 917 was your least favorite car, but you had your first of three Daytona wins in that car in 1970. That must have been a very wild 24. Tell us about that race and who was your co-driver?
Well, going back a little bit on the 917, it happened because, as you know, the FIA and the CIS changed the rules in 1968 for 1968 after American Big Rock Fords had won Le Mans twice in 66 and 67. And so they changed the rules and they said no more big engines. So the maximum size for a prototype was 3 liter, 3,000 cc. But if you made 50 cars, then you could have 5 liter. And nobody built 5 liter cars, and so they reduced the required number to qualify from 50 to 25. And Porsche immediately jumped in and built 25 917s, actually 4.5 liters, because they were using the pistons and connecting rods and the valves and valve springs from the well-proven 908. Only later, in the beginning of 1970, did they go to 5 liter. But in the first instance, the 25 917s were really difficult to drive. They wandered all over the road. For instance, on the Mulsanne Straight at Le Mans, 4 miles along, they just went from one side of the road to the other. You weren't counter-steering. You were just holding the wheel gently and waiting for the weave to go the other way. But, you know, it quickly established a difficult reputation.
I've had horses like that.
Exactly, yes. And in March of 1969, when the 917 was new, I got a call from Stuttgart asking me to come and test the new 917. And I thought, you know, why do they want me? They've got 6 German heroes in Germany near Stuttgart ready to go. And I'm hundreds of miles away in the north of England. And so I said, I'll call you back shortly. I just need to see if I have the time. And I called my great co-driver, the Swiss driver, Joe Sivert, in Freiburg. And I said, Seppi, have you tested the new 917 yet? And there's a long silence. And he says, no, no, Brian. We wait for the others to see what breaks first. So I couldn't go. So I took part in a Porsche test that was being attended by John Wire, for whom I'd driven in 68 in the GT40 with X. And he was now the official team entrant for 1970. And I attended a test at the Ostreichring in Austria in October of 1969. And there was Kurt Ahrens, who was the factory Porsche driver. And I was there representing John Wire. And partway through the test, we kept trying different things. We tried everything. Nothing made any difference. And at the end of that day, John Horseman, the engineer for John Wire, said there's no downforce on the tail, and they borrowed tools and equipment from the Porsche truck, and they chopped the tail off. They chopped this long tail off, and it looked like a pickup truck. And I was first out the next morning, and instead of doing 1 or 2 laps and coming back in and saying no change, no good, you know, I did 7 laps, and at the end of 7 laps, I came in and I said, now we have a race car who's 4 seconds fast, actually 3.5, and then 4 by the end of the day. So a huge, huge change. So we arrive in Daytona for the first race of the new year with the John Wire team as the official team. We didn't know that, in fact, there was another official Porsche factory car entered by Ferdinand Piëch's mother. Yeah, she was the Volkswagen and Porsche importer for Austria. And it was a big surprise to John Wire. We thought we were the only team. But anyway, off we go. Well, fairly early, we were lapping the tail enders on the 4th lap, you know, so we'd gained 4 miles in about, you know, 8 minutes. So in the early afternoon, about 3 in the afternoon, I came whistling down the back straight, and of course, no chicane in those days. And we were coming onto that banking at 200 miles an hour. And there were a bunch of Trans Am type cars ahead of me. Camaros, Mustangs.
Mm-hmm.
They were having their own race, and there was room through the middle, so I went through the middle. And just as I got to the front, just as I passed through, my left rear tire burst. And, of course, the tire did a lot of damage, you know, to the body and the oil tank, and we lost about 20 minutes. And then about 2 in the morning, I'm coming off the banking again, you know, 200 miles down, a bang as the right rear suspension fell off, and I go spinning all the way down the pit straight. And I get back, and now we lose half an hour whilst all the right rear suspension's replaced. And then early in the morning, perhaps around 7, the clutch went. So anyway, it's pushed behind the wall, and the John Wire mechanics had never changed the clutch on a 917. But with instruction from the Porsche mechanics, they changed it. But during that time, David York, the team manager, said to me, Brian, we'd like you to do a session in the Rodriguez car because we can't make Kinnunen, his co-driver, understand our instructions. He was Finnish and he didn't speak any English at all. So now I'm out in the, actually, number two car, which is leading by a long way, driving with Pedro Rodriguez and Leo Kinnunen. And, of course, towards the end of that session, I've been in for about an hour. It's not, you know, due in again shortly for fuel. And wow, Joseph, my co-driver, goes flying past in our car. And so I actually finished first in the Rodriguez car and second in our car because we overtook Mario Andretti and Jackie Hicks with a few laps to go and finished second. So I was first and second in that one.
That is hilarious.
It was.
Well, how did you like... this was your early on in your career in the States. SCCA and IMSA must have seemed sort of primitive in comparison to what you were accustomed to, or were they?
Well, due to various things, I'd made a stupid retirement to South Africa at the end of 1970, and I'd come back with no drive. And I started driving a Formula 5000 for an English, actually Irish entrant, Sid Taylor. And Porsche asked if I do a one-off drive at the Targa Florio, 44 miles to one lap and over 700 corners per lap. And I'd won it in 1970 with Joe Siffert. And Derek Bell, who took my place in the Porsche team after I'd made this stupid retirement, he'd never done it. And so John Wire called and said, Redmond, would you like to do the Targa Florio? So this was about probably March of 1971. And I went there thinking this is really a chance, you know, to get back into the big time. My co-driver, Siffert, crashed the car pretty hard the night before the race. And very unusually, John Wire said to me, Redmond, I'd like you to start the race. And I said, what for? He said, I don't want Siffert and Rodriguez knocking each other off. They were always banging into each other. So I started, and right from the start, the handling wasn't normal. And 22 miles around the 44-mile circuit, the steering broke, and I hit a stone kilometer post right in the fuel tank, and it exploded. And I was on fire from head to foot. And, of course, nobody there. Nobody came to help me for about 45 minutes. So that was a pretty unpleasant experience.
Wow. Were you okay? How badly were you hurt?
I had to have skin grafting on the back of my hands, my neck, and my face. But I was very lucky. I had an incredible Australian plastic surgeon working in Manchester in the north of England, who'd been a World War II plastic surgeon for the air guys who'd been burned. So that was, worked out okay. But it was really a very difficult year. This is 71. But at the end of 71, Sid Taylor, my Formula 5000 entrant, borrowed a BRM, British Racing Motors, Can-Am car from BRM. And we went to Imola in Italy, and it rained, and the car was really good in the rain, and I lapped the field. And the field included a factory Ferrari, Clay Regazzoni in a 312 PB, And after the race, the manager, Mauro Fregeri, came up to me and he said, "Brian, what are you doing next year?" So I had two fantastic years with Ferrari, winning the World Manufacturers Championship again in 1972.
I guess Mr. Regazzoni really liked you a lot. Okay.
Sorry, I missed all that, so I'm just going to carry on.
Okay, please do. I was just making a statement that I figured Mr. Regazzoni really liked you after that. Go ahead.
So, also in 72, the Formula 5000 car I was driving called was Chevron. Chevron were a well-known English manufacturer. And in fact, you know, they made some of the best little cars, you know, in racing at that time. They'd never built a 5000, but I'd had struggling with the McLaren that I was using, and I said to Derek Bennett, the owner of Chevron, "Can you build a 5000? And he said, "Yes." And I said, "How long and how much?" He said, 10 weeks and whatever it cost me. And I bought the only racing car I ever bought. I paid him $5,000 for a new Chevron Formula 5000 car. And the first day of practice at Oulton Park in the north of England, it broke the record. And won the first two races. And Sid Taylor said, "We're going to America, $20,000 for first place at Watkins Glen." So off we go with no money. We ship it on an open trailer with no spares. And we buy a $500 station wagon in New York, tow it to Watkins Glen. We're leading by 45 seconds from Graham McRae, who was the Formula 5000 champion. With seven laps to go, $20,000 flashing, and the battery went flat. And we finished seventh and got $4,000. But at the end of that, end of the year, we took it to Riverside for the last race of the 5000 series. And on the last lap, I'm behind Sam Posey driving a Surtees. And I'm looking to pass him, so I'm in his slipstream at about 170, coming down to turn nine, and the back of his car came at me, and I swerved, you know, to miss him. And we actually won the race, but then a protest was put in. I'd overtaken under the yellow flag. I'd never saw it. And so the chief steward came to me, and in a strong Lancashire accent, he said, "Now then, Brian, lad, I'm Joe Smith from Accrington. Accrington is 5 miles from where I lived in Burnley." But I didn't know him. And he said, "As one Lancashire lad to another, didst thou see yellow flag or not?" And I said, "No, I didn't." And he said, "Right, lad, you're the winner." So we got fined $100. And shortly afterwards, a small, slightly heavy gentleman came up to me and he said, "I'm Carl Hast, the Lola importer, Lola importer for North America. I'm forming a team with Jim Hall of Chaparral Cars for next year, and would you like to drive for us?" So that's how that all started.
Well, I've seen nice pictures of that car. It was stunning, a most beautiful car. And you were very successful with it in
76. I've got a question from the audience.
We have a question from the audience.
Got a question from the audience, Brian. I think someone read my book where you told me about your accident at St. Gervais, which was not funny, but the incident with the ambulance is worth recounting.
Yes. Would you want to give the whole story on that?
Yes, go ahead. Tell the whole story.
Well, after these four great years, you know, driving 5,000, winning the championship three times with Mario finishing second for 2 years and Alan's the second the third year, the SCCA changed the rules. It was marketing. The tracks had had better crowds for Can-Am, and Can-Am had finished in 1974. It was finished. So for 1978, the SCCA said you now have to call the series Can-Am, and you have to put bodywork on your open wheel cars. And so I arrived in St. Gervais, Canada at the end of May of 1977. I'd never seen the car before, but I knew, you know, prepared by Jim Hall and Franz Weiss and the Chaparral crew, that it would be good. So out I go, and it's good. And I came in after about 20 minutes, and Jim Hall said, how is it? I said, it's good. And he said, you know, what do you want to change the balance of the handling? And I said, drop the front wing a quarter of an inch. And on the next lap, at 160, it took off at the top of the hill at Senderead. It went about 40 feet in the air, turned over, and came down. And that broke my neck, C1, broke my left shoulder, split my breastbone, broke two ribs, and the roll bar collapsed, and I went down on the road. So my helmet was worn away each side, and I got, you know, pretty heavy battering on the head. Then it rolled, as it rolled off the road, having been upside down, it rolled onto its right side, and it was, you know, the right side up, which was good. And it was a good thing that the track doctor that weekend was a heart specialist, because my heart had stopped. So he got that going again. And then the ambulance blew a tire on the way to hospital. And when my wife arrived from England the next morning, the Montreal paper showed the ambulance, the doors open, and the two guys working on the wheel, me in the back, not looking too great. And the headline was Redmond A. Moore. Redmond is dead. And so anyway... So that was a bit of a hiccup. Yeah.
Oh, how awful.
Yeah.
And you just kept on going. You just kept on going. How long did it take you to get over that?
Well, by sort of December, I was walking and trying to run a bit. And I rang Joe Hoppen, who was the head of Volkswagen, Porsche and Audi Motorsport. And I said, you know, can you find me a car for Sebring in March? I want to see if I want to drive, you know, and if I can drive. And I said, I don't want a competitive car. So he got the second Dick Barber car. Dick Barber always had two cars. One was himself driving with top line professionals. And the second car was a rental car, really. In this case, it was Charles Mendes from Tampa, who was the Sebring organizer, and Bob Gerritsen, who prepared Dick Barber's cars. And so, against all the odds, we kept going and didn't have any problems and won the race.
And getting back to that Fitzgerald accident, the curious part is what happened to the ambulance on your way to Montreal, I guess it was. What happened there?
Just that the tire went. They blew a tire.
Yeah.
And so it was stopped, and the doors were open, so photographers were there and you know, took a photograph.
And prematurely announced his passing away.
All right. Are you still on, James?
I'm still here. No. I'm just listening.
Yeah.
I'm still here.
What was that question?
Folks, this is James Redman. Brian's son is with us.
Yeah, so what was the question?
But Trish, I was at boarding school in England and saw the headlines also. So, much fun for Mum and the family.
No, that's awful. Oh,
yeah.
These days you would have sued them. You would have taken them to court. Gosh, that's awful.
Well, the good thing, Trish, is that I wasn't brought up around racing. So Dad went away and raced. And so when I heard about these accidents, it was always a couple of weeks later.
That must have been strange.
One more question here, Brian. From the audience, where can they buy your book?
You just go online to Go Race, www.goRace.com.
Good. I've heard good things about it. I need to get that book.
And I did hear from you, Trish, that you were wondering if you could ask questions about the hurricane.
Do you want to talk about the hurricane? We call it Hurricane Brian.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was it was interesting, really, because we were stuck on an island with no means of getting off and nobody else of it. And so no communication because nothing was working. And of course, all the boats in the marina just opposite the boat, they all came back and hit the house. So the house is getting bang, 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 the roof flying off, windows bursting. And the only place to try and get protection from all that was inside the toilet. And it was just a very small toilet, because downstairs the water was 5 feet up in the bedrooms, as they were in that house, and the living area upstairs just had one small toilet. And so Marion and I are sitting in the toilet listening to all this banging and crashing and going on, you know, the roof. And of course, the three very bad accidents that I had, you don't have time to think of anything. It just happens. It's almost like a dream. It doesn't seem real. You know, it's happening, but you don't really realize it. But when you're sitting for 2 hours in a toilet, a dark toilet with no light, and listening to everything going on around you, it's a bit of a different thing. So anyway, it worked out okay, but we were pretty lucky there again.
Well, you had thousands and thousands of people worried and watching for every piece of information that we could get about your situation. I have since heard you did a video. I saw that. And it was fascinating, but scary, and how you survived that, and how you how long it took you to get off the island. I also hear that you've had been playing with royalty, that you've had dinner or tea with the Queen and went hunting with Prince Charles, who is now King, of course. I'd like to hear about that.
Well, I suppose I had two brief, you know, encounters with royalty. When I was 16, I was at a boys' boarding school in the north of England, and the headmaster called me into his study. He said, Redmond, I suggest you leave school. We can't teach you anything. So I left school at 16, and my father didn't know what to do with me. We were in the grocery business, and we had one cafe. And so they sent me to a catering college in Blackpool, where I went for 3 years. And so towards the end of that time, the Queen visited our local town, Burnley, the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh. And in the holidays, I used to go and work at a local very good restaurant called the Moorcock Inn on Waddington Fell. And the owner, Joe Robinson, actually, he was doing the catering in the town hall of Burnley for the Queen and the Duke. And so I was nominated to wait on the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh. So that was interesting. And then in the later days, when we moved from the industrial north of England, from Cone in Lancashire near Burnley, we moved about 12 miles away to the agricultural delights at Gargrave near Skipton in Yorkshire. And because James and Charlotte, they were going riding at a local riding school, and I got fed up waiting for them, so I started as well. And then I joined the local hunt club, you know, where you chase the actually hares on horseback.
it wasn't foxes, Trish. It was hares.
Well, they're fast. They can run.
Prince Charles and the Crown Equerry came and rode out with us one weekend, and Prince Charles was kind enough to offer me a sip from his hip flask containing a mixture of brandy and sherry, I think. So I guess my lips touched the same hip flask as Prince Charles. King Charles, I should say.
Oh, that's hard to get over. I love it. I love it. I'm glad that.
Another question here from the audience.
Huh?
Yeah. The audience wants to know, Brian, if you compare current Formula One with what you did back in the day in Formula One.
Well, because my Formula One experiences weren't good. Because I'd suddenly appeared Like a Star from the Permanent in 1968, driving for John Wire in the GT40 with Jackie Hicks. We'd won the Kyle Army 9-hour race, the Brands Hatch 6-hour race, and this far, Francorchamps 1000 Ks. The Cooper Car Company asked if I'd like to do Formula 1. And the first race was in South Africa and back at Kyle Army. And it was the Maserati V12 engine was pumping oil out in every direction. And John Cooper said to me, Redmond, please try and do 5 laps. We need the starting money. So I did 5 laps and retired because I was putting oil all over the track. And the next race, the Spanish Grand Prix in Jarama, Ludovico Scafiotti, my teammate, and I started last and next to last. I was last. And halfway through the race, we're 9th and 10th. 3/4 of the way through, we're 5th and 6th. And so I think if I nip past Ludovico, I might finish on the podium. And that's what happened. I was 3rd. And going round on the back of an open convertible after the race, there was Graham Hill on the right, Denny Hulme, who was 2nd, in the middle, and me on the left side. And I'd been waving to the crowd on my left, and I turned to my right to wave. And as I did that, Graham Hill turned to his left. His jaw dropped and his arm dropped, and he said, "Christ almighty, don't tell me you were bloody 3rd. So, of course, the next Formula One race, the Belgian Grand Prix, where only a month before we'd won 1,000 kilometres in the GT40. Colin Chapman wanted to see me before the race. He asked how long my contract was with Cooper and come and see me, you know, when it's over. However, on about the 7th lap of the race, the suspension broke and I had an enormous accident. I landed right in a corner worker's post, hit a parked car, which one on top of another car, and I had a compound fracture of the right forearm, and it caught fire as well. So that was a big scene. And in 1972, McLaren asked if I'd like to do Formula One race at Brands Hatch. It was a very big, the 50,000, Rothmans 50,000, and it was for any type of car, and I was told to take it easy as Emerson Fittipaldi and the Lotus would break down. It was a very long race. Unfortunately, Emerson didn't break down, and I finished on the same lap, not too far behind him. If he won, and I was 2nd. And then I had a not a very good race. The German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, 14.5 miles. I crashed it in practice. It was my mistake, but it was repaired. And I drove a very lackluster race, but finished 5th overall. And then at Monaco, I finished 5th again in pouring rain. The 2nd Goodyear tyre finisher behind Jackie Stewart. But then I had problems of all sorts. And, you know, I had to decide whether to do Formula 5000 in America or stay in Europe and do Formula 1. And I decided I'd rather be finishing at the front end of 5000 in the States than finishing in the middle to back of the field in Formula 1.
You were too busy. I don't know how in the world you kept up with yourself.
I missed that part of the question. What was that, James?
You were too busy. I don't know how you kept up.
No.
So now you're doing vintage racing. And you've got your own organizations, Target 66 and Rennsport. What's coming up in the coming year?
Yes, well, in 1981, after introducing the new Lola T600 GTP car to IMSA and winning the championship, Ralph Kent Cook's plans for 1982 weren't very good. And I went to look at Ford in Detroit. Mike Cranefuss asked if I'd like to work on the competition side there. But I went for 3 weeks and I hated the whole thing. But the plans that Ford had for 1982 with a front engine, the small turbocharged engine, weren't any good. You know, and I was listening to each department trying to get their piece of the Ford racing action. And I decided I didn't want to do it. And so he sent me to Daytona to report on the 24-hour race. And there I met Bob Snodgrass, who was the president of Brumos Porsche in Jacksonville. Right. Of course, the owner, Peter Gregg, had shot himself, and so they wanted a racing person, you know, at Brumos, and they offered me a job there, and I went. Soon after going there, I started vintage racing. We had a vintage racing sales side, and a gentleman called George Heard from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, said, "What's this car?" It was a Chevron B19, a 2-litre. And I said, "It's a Chevron. How much is it?" $32,000. "If I buy it, will you drive it?" I said, "I will, but I'm a professional driver." And George said, "What's that?" I said, "It means you pay me $5,000 a race plus expenses." I did that for 20 years. So,
I love it.
Yeah. Wonderful. And so we started, yeah, and also around the same time, 1991, we were doing a vintage race at Summit Point in Virginia with George Heard and the Chevron and Bob Hubbs, his right-hand man. And I met Bill Scott. I knew of him. I knew that he'd won the World Formula V Championship and Ford Championship, but I didn't actually know him. But he came up to me and he said, "You know, how are you doing, Brian?" And I said, "Well, it's all a bit of a struggle, but, you know." Oh, he said, "I'll tell you what, you put an event on at Summit Point, and I'll provide the track, the workers, the medical system, the ambulance, all for $1 a day. And if you ever make any money, give me a share." And so we did that for 20 years. Started off with Charlie Gibson and James, and James then took over the running of the Jefferson 500.
Thank you, Dad. Trish, you may know of Bill Scott in Summit Point. I would imagine you do.
I know by name, not by person. I'm afraid we've not met.
Okay, well, it's a brilliant time. A little local club track, and a fantastic guy. Bill was amazing.
And then in 1998, I got a call from Bob Carlson, Public Relations for Porsche Cars North America. And he said, "We're bringing 5 cars from the Stuttgart Museum to Sebring, and they're then going to go on to other places, including Laguna Seca, in, I think, in August." Yep. And so I went to Sebring, I tested the 3 cars, and then afterwards I said to Bob, "If you send those 5 cars, to Watkins Glen after they've been to Laguna Seca, I'll put on an all Porsche event." And that's what happened. And we actually had a great weekend, although of course we had some normal problems. But after that, Bob Carlson said, "If you put another event on at Lime Rock in 2001, we'll call it Rennsport 1. And that's how Rennsport started. And then after Lime Rock, he said, "We'd like to do another one at Daytona in 2004. And then we did another Daytona in 2007. And so James effectively ran those Rennsport events. And that's how Rennsport got going.
I love it. That's the way it should have been.
It was really fun, Trish. A lot of people still say the Lime Rock event was the most fun Rennsport event, because at Lime Rock, of course, it's a little park-like track. And the idea behind Rennsport was getting a bunch of friends together and playing with cars. And that's, you know, that's what we did.
And it worked. It worked very well.
Yeah.
Love it. Trying to think what's coming next.
I think we can wind
anybody,
it up.
We could. I imagine he's getting tired by now. Okay, let me.
Oh, don't worry, Trish. Dad'll talk all night, I'm sure. But
I wish he would. Have you got something else you want to tell us?
Well, Targa 66, our club event.
Yeah, I think he better talk about Targa. What exactly is Targa, for those who don't know?
Well, we started, Targa 66 around the time 1991. So this year in Palm Beach was our 31st year. And
yes.
Then they've sold the track, and so now we're going to go to Homestead next year in the middle of February. And it's a private club for people who don't particularly want to race. They can run the cars. It's like track time. We have three groups, A, B, and C, depending on the driver performance, driver experience, and the speed of the car. And they go out for 30 minutes each group. So like at 9:30 in the morning, group C goes out, 10 o'clock, group A, group B, and then 10:30, group C. And it goes on throughout the day like that. So each entrant gets a lot of track time, and we have a very good social activities as well.
And, Dad, you can add to this, but we have some amazing cars. The College Collection, which is now called the Revs Institute, they always send cars over. So you would see Porsche 908s, GT40s, blah, blah, blah. And drivers that show up, and we always have guests too. I mean, Sterling Moss has been there. Emerson Fittipaldi has showed up. It's just a weekend for people to enjoy cars.
Are you expecting any special guests this year?
Well, who knows, Trish? In the south of Florida, you never know who might show up. Helio Castroneves came to our event at Palm Beach. Emerson.
Well, everybody lives down there. You ever heard of Raul Moselle? He used to live down there.
Well, exactly. There. Yeah, all
yep.
The South American guys are down there. Derek showed
they
up this last time.
Christian
yep,
and all the head departments.
Yeah, this last time at Palm Beach this year, there was Derek Bell, David Hobbs, Bill Orbelin, Brian Redman, and a couple of other famous drivers too.
Danny Sullivan, yeah.
Yeah, Danny, yes.
Yep.
Neat. Well, I hope you have a good one this time, and it's in February.
Yep,
am I correct
February.
With that? Right.
Yep.
Yep. No risk of a hurricane that time of year.
No, I hope not. Whatever you do, don't go where Brian Redman's going.
Homestead has been destroyed. That track was destroyed in a hurricane and had to start over.
Which one, Trish?
Homestead.
Well,
Homestead
was built because of the damage.
Right. How about that?
Anyway, it's our first time there, and we're looking forward to it because they've got garages, and now there are lots of new hotels, and I think it'll be fun.
I think it'll be fun, too, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about it as it happens, because James is very good about keeping the stuff on Facebook so we can all see it. Maybe we can have you back to talk about it when you get home.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, that'll be good.
I hope you will come
good.
Back. This time we'll be on all of our senses. We'll be right there where we can hear and talk and listen and understand each other. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
All right,
I do
Trish,
thank you so much for this. This has
thank
been
you,
fantastic.
Trish. Thank you, Trish. Love you. You don't need to keep this on the podcast, but love you
a
lot.
That's okay.
Thank you.
All right. I hope to see you soon. I guess I'll be at the MIDI. That's about
Thank
it.
Thank you. Thanks, Trish. Thanks, Dave.
Do come back. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
okay. And have a nice night.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All of our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and also on the Internet Archive, archive.org, and on iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, Spotify. Reaching millions of fans, download the app and listen on your phone, your car radio, or your computer. The stories have been great, and we appreciate so much of our audience. Thank you for your patience. It got a really rough start, but 20 minutes later, we did crank it up. Thanks so much for listening. Our next